This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on the show, we'll visit with Carl Reiner. He's been in show business for 65 years, starting in 1948. And he is a man who is still going strong as he celebrates his 91st birthday in 2 days. Carl Reiner will talk about then and now. Famous writer, producer, director. He's done it all, and he's still alive and well and lucid. And we'll find out just how much when we visit with him in the coming hour. Also on the show, John Rosengren. He writes about athletic heroes, and his latest biographical target is Hank Greenberg, the hero of heroes, one of baseball's greatest sluggers who survived anti-Semitism during World War II and served in that war fighting against Adolf Hitler. All this, now the news on 89.3 WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. You are listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge, and our special guest is Mr. Carl Reiner. He wrote and performed in your show of shows. He created the Dick Van Dyke Show. Carl Reiner wrote and directed classic movies like The Jerk. He's been a comedic titan for more than 6 decades, still a much sought-after show guest with a recent appearance on The Tonight Show with Jay Leno. Carl Reiner has won 12 Emmys, a Grammy, and has a long list of hits. He's also faced some obstacles along the way, and his 90 years are detailed in his latest work. His book is his memoir, I Remember Me. Good morning, Carl Reiner.
Good morning. You said it perfect.
Well, you have...
You described somebody I really know.
A man you like well.
Yeah, I do. I like him well when he doesn't trip. I haven't tripped lately, so I still like him.
Well, you have had an amazing voyage through show business that expands to your family, and Carl Reiner has been in the game since really the onset of television. You were there almost from the day that it was invented.
Well, you know, as a matter of fact, my first appearance on television was in 1948. I was on Broadway doing a show called, what the heck was it called? It was with Jack Hay. Oh, Inside USA. And there was a little studio, ABC, on 67th Street. It's still there. It was a horse riding rink, and the horse riding rink was still there with the sawdust, but they took the horses out, and in one corner they built a studio for news. And I did a show there called The Fashion Story. I played a photographer on a fashion story that told of a girl who was in the fashion industry, and what it was a selling Dan River fabrics. It really was a one long commercial.
My goodness, that was 1948. The year.
But I was well paid for it. I got $80 a week for that 1 hour of work. It was a windfall.
Yeah, that $80 an hour in 1948 wasn't bad. It's not bad today.
No, that and my $150 inside USA made me rich enough to have a family.
Well, you continued from there, and of course, in 1948, you had your first television series, The Fashion Story, and then your
show. Then the next one was actually a thing called The 54th Street Review. It was CBS, and I did sketches, and on that show, Max Liebman saw me, and he invited me to come. He also saw me in a Broadway show called Alive and Kicking, and he invited me to come on to the... Then became the show was called the Admiral Broadway Review that first year. The first full year, it became the show of shows I was hired on to be Sid's interlocutor.
Sid Caesar. Was there ever another like him?
No, I was saying the other day, he might have been the greatest sketch comic that ever lived. He certainly was an artist of supreme magnitude. I was out with Danny Kaye's daughter yesterday, and we were talking about the two icons. They're totally different. One was a song and dance man, and one was a strict comedian. But they ruled. They ruled their the stage, and they ruled the airwaves during that time.
Well, your show of shows included not only Carl Reiner, but also included what Neil Simon, Mel Brooks.
Oh yeah, in the writers' room there was and Neil Simon, Mel Brooks. Larry Gelbart at one time, and Joe Stein, who wrote Fiddler on the Roof and Enter Laughing, the play, adapted my book for Broadway. And there was I've described it as my college, because I was a young actor, writer at the time, but I never had seen that kind of powerhouse comedy writing, and the competition among the writers and the amalgam when they got together and decided something was funny. It was a learning experience for me, and I said that I went to the College of Max Liebman's shows.
Well, along that time, Carl Reiner started doing other things as well, including being a frequent panelist and host on several game shows. Did you like that?
I loved it. You know, I loved it only because I liked playing games. We always played parlor games, you know, charades and those things. And all of a sudden they're paying me, and it was so easy to do. You had no lines to learn. All you had to do was, when those days I wore a toupee, I had to put my toupee on straight, that's all, and nice clean clothes. And I was either a panelist or an MC, a host. And I outlined that in my book, and it was a happy day in my life because it was an adjunct to what I did, you know, an extra.
Carl's latest work is I Remember Me, but he has been a writer of renown for more than half a century, and your novel, autobiographical indeed, Enter Laughing, not only a well-received novel, but it became a long-running Broadway play, and it took a life of its own.
It took another life lately, and that was very exciting. On my there's a it was a wonderful comedy writer, worked on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, called Stan Daniels. He saw Enter Laughing, and Joe Stein adapted the book into a play, and he also adapted the play into a musical. And Stan Daniels wrote lyrics and music for this piece of work, and I saw it done in New York about 2 or 3 years ago. And I said at the time, I was among a dozen major people at that, when I call major people, Steve Martin was there, my son was there, and we all agreed that it was the funniest thing we've ever seen. As a matter of fact, Jerry Seinfeld was there that evening. He took an ad in New York Times on his phone, paid $5,000 for an ad, said, "I saw the funniest thing I've ever seen in my life, laugh from beginning to end." And it's true. And that was in a little theater called the York Theater. Well, last month, for my 75th year in show business, they did a little tribute to me at the Amundsen downtown at the theater conclave. There was it was a reading, but more than a reading, of Enter Laughing the musical, a full house. I never heard such laughter in my life, and it was this little book that I wrote in 1958. First thing I'd ever written, actually. It took on a life of its own, and I take no credit for the musical, because Stan Daniels wrote lyrics that makes people laugh from the very first song to the end. Never heard people laugh at every lyric and every song. It's an amazing thing, and I'm so grateful to him. He passed away, and when I was called on stage, I brought up his wife, and I said, if it wasn't for this woman and her husband, we wouldn't be standing here and celebrating this wonderful event. And that, as a matter of fact, the theater department there, I mean the theater group there, is thinking of including it in next year's major productions.
We're visiting with the legendary Carl Reiner, best known in a career that could have many best knowns. I think best known, you would agree, for your work with Dick Van Dyke.
Well, you know, I when asked what was the happiest days of my life, I had to say the Dick Van Dyke Show. There was 5 years, 158 shows. I lived in New Rochelle at the time, at the time I created it. And then when I moved out to the coast, I told of my life in the theatrical form of everything that went on in my days on the shows and working in New York and living in New Rochelle. And that those 5 years with Dick and Mary and Maury and Rosie and Richard Deacon, I said, were the best years of my life as far as creatively. I never had more fun going to work, and never had they threw a claim and money at you. Besides, you're having fun doing what you want to do, they pay you for it. And it was the best time of my life. I've said it a number of times.
You were married for 65 years.
Yes, to the right woman. That's a bit of, that's the best thing that ever happened to me. When I was 20 years old, I met this woman who was 9 years older than me. We met in the summer resort. She was an assistant scenic designer. I was a young actor, comedian, sketch performer, and we hit it off. And nobody believed. Yes, they did. You know, where do you two guys come together? Well, she, I've described this. I said that woman raised three great kids and one great husband. She informed everything I knew. I got to know. I wrote about it in a book, and it's very accurate. My feelings about how I got to be who I am was highly attributable to my wife, who knew about everything. She was one of these very bright women who not only was knew things, but could do things. She was a brilliant artist. Studied at the National Academy, graduated there, and had a lot of one-woman shows, and then in later years became a great jazz singer, and I have seven of her albums that I play in the car every day when I drive. She's always with me, singing in my ear from the multi-speakers. This was a life that was well-lived by myself because I found the right woman.
How has life changed for you, Carl, since Estelle's death?
You know, in the book I write about her passing, and I title the last chapter "The End," and it's a rather moving chapter, as you might imagine. But what I love about it is that I was asked to read this book, read some of the book when I was still in manuscript form. I went to a women's club, a women who write, it was called. And they asked me if I'd read something, and I read that last chapter. I released, I recited it, and there were 60 women. Somebody took a video of it, and they showed it to me. 50 or 60 women weeping copiously because of the last few moments of my wife's life, and I called that chapter "The End," and I realized after it was over that it wasn't the end, because there's no end for the living. I said, there's no end if you wake up the next day thinking about your wife all night long, every day of every day of every waking moment. You think about it. She's with you. And I said, there's no end for the living if you wake up saying, what am I going to eat for breakfast? Yeah. And then I made a list of no end for the living if you have these things that you look forward to doing, going to a sushi bar, having a friend come over for dinner. So that's how you sustain your life. And the fact is that I really did come to that conclusion walking around the block one day. I said, you know, my wife is not gone. If I'm alive, she's alive because she's in me. I cannot not think of her. And I don't want to not think of her.
Right.
But everything I look at, as a matter of fact, the house I'm living in is a house we moved into in 1961 in Beverly Hills. And we're still in that house. And every nook and cranny of this house is something she either designed or painted. Mm-hmm. You know, paintings all over her work, and it's her little temple that I pray at.
How has Beverly Hills changed since 1961?
Beverly Hills, the stores are getting bigger. There's an influx of a lot of money coming from when foreign lands topple, the rich people move out and try to find places in other countries, and a lot of them moved into Beverly Hills. And so the houses, some of the houses are getting bigger. They bought land, and they take two houses and make one out of it. No, I don't think they've done that, but I see some awfully big houses going up. But it's still ostensibly a very beautiful tree-lined street and rather common, a lovely place to live.
Now, your son, Rob, who we know well, he was, what, about 14 years old when you moved to that house, wasn't he?
Exactly. I think he was 14. And he's now 66. Yesterday I sang happy birthday to him. And he's just starting a new picture. If you can send non-toxic people into the world, nourishing people who contribute to the world some way or another, just by being good or by actually doing something, and I've got three kids that fit all those descriptions.
Hold that thought. We'll return with Carl Reiner, the fabulous writer, director, producer. He's been around for well over half a century and will celebrate his 91st birthday come Wednesday, and he's back in 90 seconds. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to WRKF in Baton Rouge. We resume our conversation with Carl Reiner, born March 20th, 1922 in the Bronx, served in the U.S. military during World War II, 1943 to 1946. I think you and Hugh Hefner may end up being the last living World War II veterans.
Oh, I doubt it. There's still a lot of those. The last World War I veteran, excuse me, the last one World War I veteran, I think, passed this last month or two ago.
How was that experience? How did that shape the rest of your life?
Well, it actually made me. Believe it or not, the Army found my niche in the Army. I was a teletype operator with the 3117 Signal Battalion when I was sent to Hawaii on my way to Iwo Jima, not knowing I was on my way to Iwo Jima. Detachment 18, I was leaving the next night, and I went to see the University of Hawaii, there was a version of Hamlet being done by GIs. There was a company there, an entertainment company run by Major Maurice Evans, and my friend Howie Morris was in it. I went backstage to congratulate Howie, who played Laertes. I said, "You were great." He says, "You have an act?" He asked me if I had an act. "Why do you ask?" I said, "Yeah, I have a couple of things I do. I got up in rec halls, you know, while I was in the Army to entertain the guys. When you're an actor, you got to get up on the stage and do something." Couldn't do a play, so I found a couple of jokes and things, and I wrote a couple of routines for myself. And I auditioned for Maurice Evans and Captain Ludden, Alan Ludden. And
Password.
They said, "We'd like to have you in the outfit." And I said, "Well, I'm going someplace tomorrow, and I'm on the detachment." And he says, "Well, we'll get you." I said, "How you can?" He says, "No, we will call." They called General Richardson, the head of the command, the base command in the Central Pacific, and they traded me like a ball player. And I got into an entertainment section where I developed myself as a stand-up performer, comedian. And I played all over the Pacific for a whole year, entertaining the troops in Saipan, Guam, Tinian, Mogmog, Palau, ending up in Iwo Jima on VJ Day, the day we defeated the Japanese, and I played for my original group that I'd been with for a year, the 3117th Signal Battalion. Here I am on stage. It's like a bad movie, like a bad Dan Daly movie, where I'm playing for my old buddies and the star of the show. It was weird and wonderful.
Mm-hmm. Carl, is there any feeling greater than being on stage and hearing people laugh?
Well, it's one of the best things that happens. I always had fun, so one of the pleasant things I've done in my life has been able to stand up and get laughs.
Is there anyone along the way you met who you didn't like?
Who I didn't like? Oh, they must have been. But the people I didn't like, I still don't like, and those are the people in government who are trying to wreck our country. I'm a very staunch liberal, and I find that the right wing of our country is doing terrible things these days, trying to stop things from happening, making not taxing rich people and trying to get poor people to pay for the. Not allowing the government to help people. I mean, I'm here because the government, I stood on the government's back. When I was a young person, my brother saw an ad for the WPA acting lessons for free. And he said, "Why don't you go to that?" I was 17. And the WPA paid a woman to teach people how to act. They also paid for people to paint the murals on post offices. They paint young musicians to learn their craft and become members of an orchestra. That was done by the government, WPA, Franklin Delano Roosevelt. And then later in radio, when I was 18 years old, there was an NYA radio workshop, another government-sponsored organization, $22 a month I got for three, we did shows for, you know, dramas, and Norman Corwin dramas, and announcing operas and symphonies. And all of that was paid for by the government. And I became an actor because the government sponsored my training. And so when they say the government can't help people, get off the government's back, I said, no, that's what the government's for. So I do have people I don't like, and those people are, I've just mentioned who they are, and they know who they are, those people who are voting badly.
Well, you've been Congress in Congress. You were born in the Bronx, but you've lived in California for a while, and that state has veered leftward in its state politics. What do you think of Jerry Brown? What do you think of the governor of California?
He's a pretty good guy. I remember supporting him when he first ran years ago for governor, and you know, I supported his father. No, he's a pretty good guy. I haven't been too involved in the local politics. I'd rather spend my time writing I Remember Me and the things I forgot to put in I Remember Me.
I think there'll
be another book. I walk around a block and say, oh, I forgot to put that in. I'm telling you, I haven't said this to anybody yet, but I think it's going to be I Just Remembered. I think we'll call it I Just Remembered.
I Just Remembered, yeah.
Yeah, because I have a couple of stories. It'll be a thinner book, but I might just get to it.
Well, you went to Georgetown?
I went to Georgetown for a year, and I happiest time of my life in the Army, because during that year at Georgetown, my wife and I got married, and I used to go out for a weekend furlough to New York. She came down and stayed in Georgetown, and so for the 11, 12 months I was there, I was a very happy soldier, young, married, and I owe Georgetown a lot. And they also taught me how to speak French. And that French came in handy, because after the war, I couldn't wait for my wife and I to go to France. We went to France every year that we could afford it, and ultimately bought a house in the south of France for 15 summers. We went there every summer.
My. Now, Carl Reiner was born on the 20th day of March, 1922, so that means he has eclipsed the 90-year mark. And not only have you done that, but you've got your wits. How do you explain the fact that you've outlived so many of your contemporaries, and that at past 90 years old, you're still with it?
I don't know. All I know is you get up and you do what you did the day before, a little slower, but you keep doing it. As long as you have your wits about you, I think that's the thing that makes it. I wake up every morning and I say, well, I can walk, I can go to the bathroom, and I can go have my breakfast. And if I think of breakfast, I know I'm all right. What am I going to have for breakfast? And right now I'm thinking of what I'm going to have for lunch, because I know I have an early lunch, and so I wasn't going to eat breakfast. And I figured, oh, I'll spend my time talking to a guy in a faraway place like yours.
Like Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
So, Jim, you saved my life. I don't have to eat. I now have a good lunch with friends.
Well, I think you've saved a lot of people's lives along the way with your laughter, and it carries on to another generation with your son, Rob. Do you remember the first time you saw All in the Family?
Oh, yes. I thought it was I said, my God, I hope they can keep this on the air. It's groundbreaking. It's awesome. But we didn't think that the audience is going to, not the audience, that the networks would allow it. You know, they touch things that nobody ever dared to touch before. On the old show, on the old Dick Van Dyke Show, we couldn't even have Mary and Dick sleep in the same bed. We couldn't say the word pregnant. And I said, my God, they're breaking every barrier. They broke the sound barrier. They broke the sex barrier. They broke everything. And it was Norman Lear, and you know, to be commended for what he did. He's an old dear friend, and I tip my hat to him all the time, because he's done so many things to make our country right.
And before I Remember Me, you wrote a book, a novel, among other works that you've written, All Kinds of Love. That was a groundbreaking book, wasn't it? About the
For me it was. You know, that's funny. I remember, I just gave somebody an advice on how to write a novel, using that as an example. I sat down, and by the way, this is the way I usually write. I've done it many times. I didn't have an idea when I wrote All Kinds of Love. I said to myself, and I've always said this myself, I write a first line, write any first line. And the first line I wrote was, if I never forget it, he didn't realize that hiring a Japanese tutor would impact his marriage as it did. That was the first line. I said, okay, who is this guy? why did he hire a Japanese tutor? I said, well, he's probably going to go to Japan. Why is he going there? Well, And then I said, what am I going to make him? I said, I make him a director, you know, that's what I am. I'll make him a producer of films. I'm a half-assed producer, but it's not me, you know. I direct and write mainly. Producing is, you know, something a director can do without having the title. And I said, make him producer. And then I said, why didn't it impact his marriage? And then the Japanese tutor, I said, well, if he hired a Japanese tutor, think it's going to be a guy. Turns out to be a girl, beautiful woman. And that opened it up. And then I didn't know where it was going. And it turned out to be a book with all kinds of love. Mother love, love of children from parents, love of homosexual love, lesbian love, and then real deep love, you know, the love of a husband and wife, and which turns out to be the youngest people in there, you know, the ones who have that that episode.
Not bad for a man who's the son of a watchmaker.
Well, my father, being a watchmaker, was also an inventor. And I saw my father every day of his life, every day of my life, out of his life. No, he was living and working in the house as a watchmaker. And I was home from school every day, and I sat on a thing, and I chatted with him every day. I saw him all day, every day. And I saw his work ethic. He had a tremendous work ethic. And when he wasn't working to make a living, he was working to invent something. He invented things that did get patents, like the battery, the clock that runs on a battery. That was his invention. He got a patent. He invented, there's a thing in the book where I talk about my father taking a picture of himself. He was a photographer, and he had a lot of, as a young kid, he had daguerreotypes, and he took pictures of everybody, but never any picture of himself until he finally decided to make a contraption, a self-timer, which he invented, that would able him to pose for himself and get in place before the timer went off. He focused the film, the camera on a chair, got into the chair, and when he sat down, the timer went off.
Uh-huh.
Anyway, so he did things like that. So I think the kind of, I always have my father in my head when I'm doing anything that needs thought. I'll think of him, and he'll say, don't rush it. Don't just stop. He says, take whatever the problem is, look it over from all sides. His was physical, so he said, turn it over, look it over, and from all angles. He says, the solution will come to you.
Do you think you'll make 100?
Oh, no, I doubt it. I have a nephew, my nephew George Shapiro, who's also Jerry Seinfeld's manager. He's one of the great human beings in my life. He's my wife's nephew. I've known him since he's 12, but he's also my manager. And he made a deal with me. He said, I'll pick up your option till you're 94, and then you're on your own. So I've got to go up to 94 for an option. Then it's a year option, yearly option after that.
You're getting close.
Yeah. But you don't want to hang around if you're not compos mentis. I just had a friend who passed away yesterday, and at 87, and his last year was so painful. Nobody wants to have to go through pain like he did.
Well, you have eased the pain of many, and it's great that you're living in the same house that you and Estelle shared for a quarter century, half century.
And I decided that I'm going to, you know, it's not a good idea, but I'd like to have a Viking funeral. I want to stay in this house. No, as a matter of fact, my wife was cremated, and there's a story. I don't know if it's in the book, but one day, in the last few months, she always loved catalogs. My wife, even when she was bedridden, she'd look through catalogs and order certain things, you know, food or things for the house that might be of interest. And after she had passed, a few weeks after she passed, a package came, and our housekeeper said, oh, another package came for Estelle. I said, no, that's not for Estelle. That is Estelle. It was her remains that the Neptune Society, the ashes, her ashes are upstairs in her bedroom, sitting on the stool she used to sit on when she sang at the club. And I told my kids, I said, when I go, I said, get the Neptune Society to do what they did for Mom, cremate me, mix Mom and my ashes together, and put us in the tomato garden in the backyard, and that's going to be my final resting place. Yeah, I hope. I don't know. They may do something else, but I don't much care. Well, being a confirmed atheist, I know that this is it. That's why I'm enjoying life so much. This life couldn't be better. There couldn't be anything better than the life I've lived.
Well, some would say I just buried the lead. I should have asked you earlier. You haven't wavered on your atheism.
Am I atheist? No, I've even gotten stronger. As a matter of fact, I know that people get a lot of solace from believing that there is a hereafter. And, I'm glad that people find ways to make themselves comfortable on this earth. But the way I found myself comfortable is make yourself a good life while you're living it. The people who were needing somebody else are usually not having as good a life as they would want on this earth. And, it's not hard to become an atheist when you realize we went through a war. By the way, they found out that during that war, when Hitler decided to kill off millions of people, there were many, many more millions than we thought. There was a new war. Somebody found some more records of the deaths, and they said, anyway, and I'm saying, if there was a God, all these 18 million people, 20, 30 million people, all imploring God to save them, help them. I said, what was he doing? What was he busy making flowers? What was it? You know, I mean, if you want to go along with the idea that there is a supreme being, he certainly was, as Woody Allen said, if there is a God, he was an underachiever. I'm pretty darn sure that when I leave here, this is it. And I'm glad I was here.
Well, we're glad you were with us today. Carl Reiner, I Remember Me is his latest work. Thank you, Mr. Reiner.
Oh, by the way, I wanted to say one thing they told me to mention. There's an e-book on I Remember Me that has me singing and dancing and pictures of the kids. I don't know what an e-book is, but they said they showed it to me, as a matter of fact. I said, I don't know how you put that together, but my publishers did, and they said, tell people it's an e-book. You can get it on Amazon or wherever you get books.
Yeah.
I was told to say that.
Well, I'm glad you did. Carl Reiner is a man of many talents. In a few minutes, we'll hear about another American born in New York City just a decade before Carl Reiner. Henry Benjamin Greenberg, better known as Hank Greenberg, born in the big city, January 1st, 1911, 1111. Hank Greenberg lived to be 75 years old, and throughout his 12-year baseball career and 4 years of military service, he heard cheers wherever he went, along with anti-Semitic taunts. The abuse drove him to legendary feats that put him in the company of the greatest sluggers of the day, including Babe Ruth, Jimmy Fox, and Lou Gehrig. His biographer is John Rosengren, and we will talk with John Rosengren about the remarkable life and times and legacy of Hank Greenberg, two-time most valuable player in the American League. This is Jim Inkster. You're listening to 89.3 WRKF in Baton Rouge. And our guest at this time is a man who is a prolific writer and has written much of his work regarding sports icons, John Rosengren, an award-winning author of 7 books. His latest work is Hank Greenberg, the Hero of Heroes. Baseball in the 1930s was more than the national pastime. It was a cultural touchstone that galvanized communities and gave a struggling country its heroes amidst the woes of the Depression. And Hank Greenberg, one of the most exciting sluggers in baseball history, gave the people of Detroit and beyond a reason to be proud. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Jim.
Hank Greenberg, 6'4", bigger than life, dominating the American pastime at a time when Hitler was taking control of Europe. What was it like in those times with Hank Greenberg, perhaps the world's most prominent Jew, being such a force on the diamond while tanks were rolling and Hitler was taking control across the sea?
Well, as you point out, it's important to understand Hank Greenberg, to understand the times. in which he played. It was much different then as it is today. I mean, you mentioned the anti-Semitism in Europe. There was also rampant anti-Semitism in the United States, where anti-Semitism was practiced and accepted, much like the Jim Crow laws. Also, it was a time of strong ethnic identification. Many of the people, like Greenberg, whose parents had emigrated from Romania, were second-generation Americans looking to find their way in the New World, and yet they had strong ties still with the old culture, and they lived in neighborhoods that were, with similar ethnic backgrounds. Baseball provided a platform for someone like Greenberg, who was a star at the level of Lou Gehrig and Ted Williams and Joe DiMaggio, to be noticed and idolized, and also to serve as this standard bearer for the Jews of his generation. So he kind of showed them the way how to assimilate, and at the same time was someone that they rejoiced in. You know, as you mentioned, he's 6'4", 220. The minute he steps on the field, starts slugging home runs, he shatters all these stereotypes about Jews being unathletic and weak and bookish, et cetera. So he, given that context, he did rise to the status of being the most popular and prominent ball player of his day.
Well, he was a great player, and as you note, there were many other great players during that time, and Hank Greenberg in his day, the raw numbers, 1934, 63 doubles in 153 games. A year later, 170 runs batted in. In 1937, 183 runs batted in. And in 1938, he had 58 home runs. He had a fabulous career, but he retired at the age of 36. Did he have some gas in the tank when he decided to call it a career?
Well, it's interesting. I was speaking with my 10-year-old son about that just last night, and he was saying he was only 36 when he retired. And I said, yes, well, the times were different. I mean, for many athletes, they're considered to be washed up by 30, and that was the prevailing theory at the time, that at 30, the athletic skills started to deteriorate and the fitness couldn't be gotten back. It wasn't like today where the athletes know a lot more about conditioning, about nutrition, et cetera, and can extend their careers. Greenberg had missed over 4 years because of his time in the military. I think that took a toll on him and shortened his career. But also his legs were starting to give out. He had a problem with his elbow. And so he thought about, Bill Veeck tried to talk him into making a comeback or playing another year in 1948 when he hired him with the Indians. And Greenberg was prepared to step in as a backup if needed. But in the end, he wasn't needed, and he decided it was time to retire.
Well, he left the game at the age of 36, but what a remarkable tenure he had as a professional player. And he was operating in a city that was, at that time, one of the great American cities, still is, but it's lost some of its luster, Detroit. How did the Motor City embrace Hammer and Hank?
Well, the Detroit, of course, was this important industrial city in the United States, and in the early 30s, it was the fourth largest city in the country with the Motor City and the auto industry anchored there. But when the Depression came along, it was the things got very grim and dark. It hit Detroit very hard with the plants shutting and the soup lines extending around the corner. So when Greenberg in 34 helped his team to the pennant, the city went delirious with excitement. They finally had a diversion and something to cheer and feel good about. Detroit hadn't won a pennant in 25 years. And then they lost a seven-game series to the Cards that year in 34, but they came back, won the pennant again, and then won the World Series in 35. That was a very bright spot for Detroiters. Now, on the flip side, Detroit was also a hotbed of anti-Semitism. Henry Ford was considered the arch-anti-Semite of America, writing these screeds against Jews in the 20s. Father Charles Coughlin, a Roman Catholic priest in the suburbs of Detroit, had a radio show with 10 million listeners that listened rapidly to him spew propaganda. It sounded like it could have been written by Hitler's goons. And so he entered this kind of hostile environment and yet won over a lot of critics by his success and his charming good nature.
The guest is John Rosengren. He is the biographer of Hank Greenberg, 331 career home runs for Hank and a .313 lifetime batting average. As you note, John, he missed three full seasons, parts of two others, 1941 through 45, basically lost five seasons to World War II. What was he doing in the war?
Well, in his first stint, he was in charge of an anti-tank division, but it was, remember, this is 1941, before America gets into the war, so it was all here in the U.S. After the U.S. entered, oh, and he was interested, when he discharged December 5th, 1941, eager to get back to baseball, resume his career. Of course, Pearl Harbor got bombed 2 days later. Hank was the first major leaguer to re-enlist. He did some kind of cushy duty here, overseeing athletic programs, but then he decided he wanted to get more into the action, so he went overseas, was in the China-India-Burma theater, where the B-29s were base to launch their attacks on the Pacific theater. Anyway, he, when he was, so, and then he came back and he actually did another stint, kind of being a cheerleader at factories where production was down, trying to rouse people to get back into the war effort. But he spent a total of 47 months in the military and missed, like, you know, prime chunk of his career. He went in the reigning AL MVP and came out feeling like an old man.
But in 1946, when he returned to Detroit, he led the league, the American League, in home runs and runs batted in. And then the following year, he goes to Pittsburgh in the National League, 1947. And that was the year that Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier in the National League. Did Hank and Jackie have any interaction?
They did. And actually, Hank Greenberg was one of the few opponents to support Jack, and at a particularly critical time, I might add, in early May 1947, Robinson went public with the abuse he'd been receiving and revealed how he'd been getting threats to have his infant son kidnapped and to even death threats against himself. And then the Dodgers went to play in Philadelphia, and the Philadelphia players pointed bats at Robinson as though they were rifles. The manager, Ben Chapman, a noted anti-Semite and bigot who Greenberg called out, had his pitchers throwing at Robinson. From there, Robinson went to Pittsburgh for the series with Greenberg's team. Greenberg was dismayed to hear his own teammates, many of them from the South, unfortunately, saying nasty things to Robinson. They had a collision at first base when Greenberg was playing first base. Robinson bunted. The throw went wide. They collided. Robinson went down, and the crowd just kind of held its breath because everyone had been expecting a race riot to break out, you know, over some incident on the ball field with Robinson. And it may have, had that player not been Greenberg involved in the collision. He just went after the ball. Robinson ran to second. The next inning, Greenberg walked, and Robinson was playing first, and he said, "Hey, listen, I'm sorry. I should have asked, how are you? Are you okay? Were you hurt?" Robinson said, "No, I'm fine. I just lost my balance." Greenberg said, "Listen, hang in there. You're doing great. Keep it up. You're going to be fine." Later, when Robinson would tell that story, he said, "Class tells. It sticks out all over Mr. Greenberg." Huh. But that support Greenberg gave came at a very critical time for Robinson to keep going.
A distinctly American hero, Hank Greenberg, Henry Benjamin Greenberg. He was born January 1, 1911, in New York City. And he's buried in Los Angeles, and he became famous in Detroit. That's truly an American odyssey, isn't it?
It certainly is. And also his journey in the consciousness of Americans. I mentioned his time in the military. When he reenlisted in 40, he'd been a hero to the Jews, but when he reenlisted in 41 after the attack on Pearl Harbor and was willing to sacrifice his career to serve the country, Americans embraced him as the epitome of, you know, the immigrant assimilated into America, willing to serve his country, and it elevated him to a high hero status.
He died in 1986, so he was certainly old enough to appreciate his fellow Jew, Sandy Koufax, and Sandy's heroics with the Dodgers. Was he a fan?
He was, though he'd become... I'm sorry, you're asking, was Sandy a fan of Hank?
I guess both, but was Hank a fan of Sandy in the 1960s?
I think so, but, you know, the times have changed some where there was more acceptance in the United States and it was not a Colfax's Jewishness was not as significant to his identity as Greenberg's was to his 30 years earlier, though obviously Colfax sat out 65, the first game of the World Series. But Greenberg had a lot of respect for Colfax. I'm not sure they ever had much interaction.
As you note, in 1934, a memorable World Series, and that was when Hank was in full bloom at the age of 23, his career just getting off the ground. He runs into 30-game winner Dennis, it was before Denny McClain, who ended up playing for Detroit. Of course, it was Dizzy Dean of the St. Louis Cardinals. Dizzy was the last person to win 30 before Denny, and no one has since. But those two, that was quite a battle, the pitcher and the slugger, right?
It was. I mean, Dean was obviously the ace, a 30-game winner for the Cardinals, and Greenberg in 34 had his breakout season, established himself as a star in the league. And Dean came out on top with that matchup, including the final game, Game 7. He struck Greenberg out three times. The footnote to it was that he humiliated Greenberg by laughing at him from the mound, and he'd also been hurling some ethnic insults, calling him Mo, short for Moses, before the game. I think it was some of that psychological warfare players engaged in at the time, which was much more common in that form in those days. But at the same time, it's an example of some of the abuse Greenberg had to endure from opponents.
How did Hank respond?
Well, he admitted that it rattled him more than it should have. You know, at this time, he's 23 years old. He's still a young guy trying to find his way. But over the years, he seemed to toughen up mentally, and he channeled that anger he had in others toward his success and came out on top more often than not in those battles.
Did he ever voice his thoughts about the Third Reich?
You know, I haven't seen any record of that other than he said after the fact when he was hitting his home runs in 1938, when he hit 58 home runs and he was trying to break Babe Ruth's single-season home run record, he was very much aware of the fact of what was happening in Europe and with Hitler, and also he understood how people were looking to him to as a standard-bearer for his for the Jews. And so he completely understood the significance of what he was doing and what it would mean to the Jewish community if he were to break Babe Ruth's record. So later he said, you know, he felt like every home run he was hitting was a home run against Hitler.
He fell too short of the record in 1938. He had people rooting for him and against him, didn't he?
Right. There were many who wanted to see him break the record, and then there were many who didn't want to see him break the record, and I think for two reasons. One, Babe Ruth was immensely popular. He was the first true celebrity ball player. You know, people just loved the Babe. As you know, natural to nobody wanted to see their hero's record broken. At the same time, there was also anti-Semitism that stood in Greenberg's way, and there were pitchers who wouldn't throw him good pitches because they didn't want to see a Jew break Babe Ruth's record. At the same time, there were opponents who were rooting for Greenberg, fans of his, because he was such a charming, good guy, and they even grooved him some pitches that helped him.
Did Hank, was he an observant Jew?
You know, I think he was more observant than people give him credit for. In 1934, he faced a dilemma whether or not to play on the High Holy Days. He had promised his parents he wouldn't. And yet the Tigers were in a tight pennant race with the Yankees, and so the community and his team expected him to play. Ultimately, he decided to play on Rosh Hashanah. He ended up hitting two home runs, winning the game for the Tigers 2-1 over the Red Sox. And then 10 days later, he decided not to play on Yom Kippur, and the team lost. But by then, the Tigers had a 7-game lead, and the pennant pretty much wrapped up. But often when people tell that story, they say that he was really just considering not playing out of respect to his parents, but he was actually more observant, I discovered in my research. He would go to synagogue on his own when he was in the minors and even when he was in Detroit. He would seek out matzah and Passover, and his religious background mattered, I think, deeply to him. Throughout his career, he never played on Yom Kippur. He did play on Rosh Hashanah, but he became disillusioned with religion toward during the war, and when he saw what religion did, kind of the harm done in religion's name. He remained steadfastly proud of his Jewish roots and heritage and a strong supporter of Israel and the creation of that state, but he, after the war, was not observant and didn't raise his children to be observant either.
The book is Hank Greenberg, The Hero of Heroes, from John Rosengren, story about one of the most important Americans of the 20th century. Thank you, John.
Well, thank you, Jim. My pleasure. Appreciate it.
Take care. And thank you for listening today. For Kevin Gallagher, I'm Jim Inkster. We'll be back tomorrow. Stay tuned.
Podcasts of The Jim Inkster Show are available at WRKF.org. The Jim Inkster Show is produced in association with the Louisiana Radio Network and is copyrighted by WRKF for the private use of its audience. Any other use of any portion of this program without the written consent of WRKF is prohibited. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of WRKF, its officers, and members.